Don't get me wrong. Some of my favorite episodes that I've hosted here on the Lost Ballparks podcast have been with guys that I grew up watching play, like Cal Ripken Jr. and Johnny Bench, Ozzie Smith, broadcasters like Bob Costas and John Miller. But if you go back through the Lost Ballparks podcast catalog, I think that you'll find, at least for me anyway, that some of the best episodes are actually with folks who were behind the scenes. Clubhouse managers, ballpark architects, organists, groundskeepers. They've got some of the best stories, and a lot of them have never been told. And I'm really excited to bring you another one today.
This is Harry Carey with Jack Buck and Jerry Gross from the beautiful new Bush Memorial Stadium. And boy, I tell you, this is some sight.
The crowd still is coming in. The bleacher area in center field almost filled. And the indication is that it's going to be a fine Friday night crowd here at the Polo Grounds.
We're underway in the first of a twi-night doubleheader at Tiger Stadium.
Greetings, baseball fans. This is Mel Allen greeting you from Yankee Stadium in New York City.
The F&M Schaefer Brewing Company, very happy to be pouring it to you from Ebbets Field tonight. And this should be a humdinger.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is Al Helfer with Art Gleason bringing you Mutual's Game of the Day from sunny Shy Park in the city of Philadelphia.
Just the start of things. Don't pull up a comfortable chair. If you want to take your shoes off, go ahead. Wiggle your toes, and we hope you'll have a cold Schaefer or two throughout the evening.
Warren Brown worked in the clubhouse at Crosley Field for the Cincinnati Reds, would later become a bat boy at Riverfront Stadium, and he's got some great behind-the-scenes stories to share from the Big Red Machine. Warren, welcome to the Lost Ballparks podcast. I appreciate you doing this. You and I have talked at length, so I know that your first major league game, the first one you ever went to, was at Cincinnati's Crosley Field.
Yes, indeed. Today's game is to be played right here at Crosley Field, which has been the home of the Cincinnati Reds for as long as the oldest citizen can remember.
Can you talk about that experience?
You know, it's something that you never forget, your first major league game. You walk into Crosley Field, you see the green grass, the scoreboard, the terrace.
The field itself here at Crosley has undergone various changes. At one time, the batters batted toward the home plate instead of away from it. And speaking of the home plate, it was once located some 20 to 30 feet directly to the rear of its present site. It has been gradually moved forward as the necessity for more seating capacity has increased.
And the sounds in the ballpark, you hear the vendors selling beer and selling hot dogs, and then you smell the hot dogs, cigars back in the day too. And it's just your first trip to a major league stadium, as you've discussed before, I think is something that you never forget. And it just gives you such an awesome memory. And it's something that stays with you forever.
And back in the early mid-60s, Ronnie Dale would have been playing the organ. And, it wasn't maybe the wall of sound that you would experience at ballparks today. There was a time to relax and have conversation with whoever you went to the game with.
Absolutely. And Ronnie was a fixture at Crosley Field. He played before the game. Everybody knew him. He played in between innings, and he played well after the game, too, entertaining the fans as they left the ballpark.
How did a USO tour featuring Joe DiMaggio lead to your job as a Cincinnati Reds bat boy in the mid-1960s?
So we moved from West Virginia to Cincinnati in the mid-1960s, and my mom was a registered nurse. And the job that she got in Cincinnati was the head nurse at the U.S. Public Health Clinic in downtown Cincinnati. And they dealt a lot with the military and the other security services that traveled overseas for the government. And so they had all of the shots and vaccinations that you needed when you traveled overseas. So the baseball commissioner's office had arranged for a USO tour featuring Joe DiMaggio. And they contacted Pete Rose. And they asked Pete, we want you and Joe to be the headliners. There's other ball players attending as well. And of course, Pete said yes. Why wouldn't he? And so they scheduled that tour, and Pete needed to get all his shots. So for over a two-week period, Pete would visit my mom's clinic every day to get shots. She kind of pulled rank on everybody and said, when Pete comes in, who happened to be my favorite Reds ball player, she gave him the shots, and she got to have a conversation. And I guess she got comfortable enough to ask him, hey, I've got a son that's going to be turning 16 soon. He would love to have a job down at the ballpark in Crosley Field. And of course, she's thinking, oh, if I can just get him down there to sell peanuts or popcorn, what a great experience he'll have just working at the place where the Reds play ball at. He said, well, I'll tell you what, when I get back from Vietnam, I'll give you a call. Everybody that my mom worked with, all the other doctors and nurses and administrative staff says, well, that's fine. You tried. Pete probably gets this request 100 times a day, and you'll never hear from him. Pete gets back from Vietnam and calls my mom. and he tells her, there's a guy you need to call. And this guy happens to be the Reds equipment manager, Bernie Stowe. She calls Bernie, and I talk to Bernie in September of 1969. Bernie leaves tickets for a Reds game. They were good seats. They were his tickets, but I didn't get to see any of the game. Bernie picks me up in the first inning, takes me back to the Reds clubhouse, brings me back to my seat in the ninth inning.
The umpire is dusting off the plate. Last of the ninth inning here at Crosley Field is about to start.
So I had about a two-hour interview, and, you know, I'm interviewing in the Reds clubhouse, which was kind of unbelievable at the time, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, what did you think when you walk in there? What were your impressions of the clubhouse?
This was a palace. This was the palace of the fans, so to speak.
Right.
And I was inside there, and it was kind of a surreal moment, but Bernie and I became so close. He was like a second dad to me, and we immediately hit it off. During the course of the interview, Bernie wanted to find out, was I going to be overwhelmed by this? Was I interested in it? And so the final analysis was, Bernie offered me the job, and he said, you're going to work long hours, it's going to be hard work, and you're going to get virtually no pay.
Yeah, you were like, okay, I'm in. Where do I sign?
I have the best job in the world. I'm working in a major league clubhouse.
Let's talk about opening day 1970 at Crosley Field. It's not only, by the way, your first day, but also new skipper Sparky Anderson.
Yes, Sparky was hired. The headlines were Sparky who? Sparky is as good a manager as there has ever been in Major League Baseball, and he's a better person.
What were your responsibilities your very first day there at Crosley Field?
Well, I was not the bat boy. I was one of the clubhouse guys. One of my regrets is I never made it on the field as bat boy at Crosley Field, but walking into the clubhouse with players there for the first time, Bernie kind of said, you know, I'm going to give you guys about 15 minutes to be in awe of being here and being around these guys. And then you've got to get to work because we've hired you. So I took my 15 minutes and then I was off to work.
Take me around the clubhouse there. Who are you seeing for the first time?
Johnny Bench, Pete Rose, Tony Perez, Lee May, Tommy Helms. Some rookies made the ball club. Davey Concepcion, Hal McRae.
Once you get out of your system that, okay, I'm here with these guys that I, just a couple weeks ago, I'm collecting their baseball cards, and now I'm in the clubhouse with them. What are some of the first things you had to do?
Well, we had to take care of the clubhouse, make sure all the players' spikes were ready to go. We had to make sure that their lockers were all in order and all the appropriate things were there for them. And basically, you know, if they needed an errand run or something, do that for them. One of my primary responsibilities, and you've heard about the players having to walk through the stands to get from the clubhouse to the Reds dugout. And that was the case, by the way. One of my responsibilities was to take the jug of Gatorade out to the Reds bullpen. So I had to walk through the stands and take that Gatorade out before the game and then do the same thing after the game. So the fact that the players would be able to converse with the fans at Crosley Field is 100% correct.
The clubhouse at Crosley Field was behind the grandstand on the third base side. So then how would players, bat boys, and coaches get to the dugout?
They would literally have to walk through the stands and then get on the field and then walk down to the dugout on the field. There was a little runway there, but it was in full view of the fans. And you've heard stories of players having birthdays and fans giving them birthday cakes and just crazy stuff.
How much did you get paid when you were at Crosley Field?
First year at Crosley Field, we got paid $5 a game and $7 for a doubleheader.
29 doubleheaders. That's like 12, 14 hours a day.
So break that down per hour. Yeah. Now, when we moved to Riverfront, we got a major pay raise, Mike. We got paid $7 for a single game and $10 for a doubleheader.
Unbelievable. Is it true that players would let you take their cars out for a spin while they were on the road?
Oh, it's absolutely true. The two I remember mostly, I had this Dodge Challenger that Bobby Tolan had. And then after the trade with Houston, Joe Morgan had this Mercury Marquis.
This is the new Mercury Marquis, maybe the best riding car in the world.
And I was able to take that home. Now, my mom was totally against me taking the car out after I drove it home. But I did take it out, and let's just say I probably got a couple dates that I wouldn't have gotten if I was driving my car.
Yeah, I mean,
just to be fair.
Think about it. You're 16 or 17 years old, and you're driving Joe Morgan's Mercury Marquis around town.
And I would probably be terrified today to even do that.
Yeah. And Joe Morgan's car wasn't the only thing of Joe's that you took out for a spin.
No. I was really astounded to hear the story with the Phillies kid who was bat boy, David Kessler.
Oh, right.
About his reference when he broke in spikes for Joe Morgan during one of the series in the early 70s. I, too, broke in spikes. When I became bat boy in 71, the Red second baseman was Tommy Helms. And Tommy and I had the same shoe size, so I broke in Tommy Helms' spikes, which I never had to wear my spikes. I always had a good-looking spikes because you always wanted to look good when you're on the field. And when Tommy got traded, you know, I was saying, oh, that's a bummer. 72 is going to be my last year as bat boy before I go away to college. And sure enough, the Reds get Joe Morgan. Joe and I are about the same size at the time. And I broke in Joe's shoes all through the 72 season as well.
And for a kid, I can remember in high school, the first time I got metal cleats, the sound it makes on concrete or on rocks, to me, was the greatest sound ever. So here, it's not only do you get to make that sound, but you get to make that sound in Joe Morgan's shoes and his cleats.
Yeah. And when we got to Riverfront, there was a long runway underneath the stands to where it didn't have to go through the stands like we did at Crosley. But and the click clack of those spikes against the concrete. Yeah, it was a sweet sound, let me tell you.
when Joe Morgan, as you talk about, got traded to the Reds from the Astros, a request came in to make sure that his locker was next to who? And why was that?
Bernie Stowe was equipment manager, and the Reds make this trade with Houston at the winter meetings in 1971. And Bernie gets a call from Bob Housen, and Bob Housen tells Bernie, hey, we've made this trade. We're trading these players. We're acquiring these players. And I never forget when Bernie told me this. He said, Bob said to Bernie, Bernie, can you do me a favor? Now, here's the CEO and general manager of the Reds asking the equipment manager, can you do me a favor? But that's how Bob Housen communicated with people. He asks Bernie, when you assign the players to lockers, can you put Joe next to Pete? And of course, Bob and Sparky had talked about this prior to the trade. And, you know, the rest is history. As we well know, as far as baseball fans, Joe became the best player in baseball in the 75-76 seasons. And you wanted to know the reason for that. Well, it was kind of unfair. Joe had a reputation down in Houston as kind of a moody ball player at times, maybe when his offense suffered. I certainly didn't see it at all in Cincinnati, but the reputation was there. Bob wanted Joe to be around Pete, who was Mr. Intense, Mr. Always Positive, Mr. This is the greatest game. I can't believe I'm getting paid to play this game. They became best friends.
Yeah, and you say that Pete Rose was one of the good guys in the clubhouse, right? So if a player got traded to the Reds, he was one of the first guys to make sure they felt welcome.
That is correct. When Pete made the ball club, he beat out a pretty popular ball player at second base in the early 60s by the name of Don Blasingame. And Pete was a little brash, you know, running to first base, head first slides, something that ball players really didn't do at the time. And from what I've read, it put off some of the veteran ball players of the Reds. So Pete, having experienced that early in his career, never wanted anybody joining the club to experience that. And I still remember one player, the Reds made a what was considered a minor deal at the time, which turned out to be a pretty good steal in acquiring George Foster from the Giants. And I still remember the first day George Foster came in to the clubhouse, and Pete was the first guy to welcome him to the club. Back in the day, it was like more of a family atmosphere in the clubhouse, on the team, and for that matter, in the front office as well. Pete did that on the ballplayer side, and Pete's wife, Carolyn at the time, did that for the players' wives too, if they were married, made sure that the wife felt welcomed into the new team as well, because, you know, it's kind of hard on guys and families to get traded.
Speaking of Pete, every time he got a hit, you noticed that he did something with his bat.
Yes. And whether Pete got a hit or got an out, he would come back to the bat rack and he would look to see where he hit the ball because it made a mark on the bat. And then he would take rubbing alcohol and rub that spot away so that the next time he came up and went back to the bat rack to see what he did, where he hit the ball at, he would have a good idea if it was a little bit different. I watched that and I was amazed at it. And then you look, he would make changes in the middle of a game. So if he was like a little bit late on the fastball, he might move a little bit back in the batter's box. If the guy was a good curveball pitcher, he might move a little bit forward to maybe get the ball before it curved a lot or going towards the plate or backing off the plate. He just made in-game adjustments that were really interesting to watch. The interesting thing is, and I've thought about this a lot, for an everyday player, the difference between a 250 and a 300 hitter is just one hit a week. And the first time I heard that, I went, that can't be right, because I'm kind of a stats geek anyway. So I put pencil to paper, and sure enough, season's about 26 weeks long. And if you get 26 more hits, your batting average is not 250, it's 300.
Tony Perez mentored a lot of the Latin players and spent some time teaching you too, didn't he?
Yes, he did. I took German in high school because it was easiest foreign language to take. But my first words I learned in Spanish were cerveza, which is beer from Tony Perez.
That's so great. June 24th, 1970, the Reds played their final game at Crosley Field.
Just one of those things. It's been a great place. There's been a lot of memories here. First night game, first baseball game, a lot of good players. And I just hope that we can accomplish the same thing with the new stadium when we move into it.
Were you and the other bat boys and clubhouse guys responsible for helping move equipment, bats, hats, and balls to Riverfront Stadium, or did somebody else do that?
No, we were responsible for moving everything to Riverfront Stadium. Matter of fact, the Reds had a short three-game road trip that Bernie Stowe did not go on, which was very unusual. And Bernie and the three guys, myself, Mike Long, and Jim Werke, we stayed with Bernie, and we basically did not go home taking things from Crosley Field over to Riverfront Stadium, and actually sleeping on equipment trunks at Riverfront Stadium before the carpet was put in the clubhouse. It's a good thing we were 16 and 17 years old that we could do that.
And I know you're young at the time, so, you know, the newness of Riverfront Stadium probably feels exciting, but was there any part of you, because your first game was at Crosley Field, like, wow, this is kind of sad?
It was kind of sad. I mean, Crosley Field was, since I became a Reds fan and followed them on the radio and listening to Wade Hoyt.
The temperature here at Crosley Field and in Cincinnati is a pleasant 76 degrees. There's not a cloud in the sky, rather warm, and another beautiful, wonderful day for baseball.
Crosley Field, it's still my favorite ballpark. And while the clubhouse was small, it was cinder block, no air conditioning, so it was hot and humid in there, especially in the dog days of the pennant race. I still have great memories of that. Now, when we moved to Riverfront, the clubhouse was many times the size of Crosley Field's clubhouse, maybe four or five times the size. We had a big equipment room. There was a huge training room. There was actually an exercise room with Nautilus equipment in there, and it was carpeted and it was air conditioned. But still, I have fond memories of Crosley Field.
In the fall of 1970, by this point, the Reds were playing at Riverfront Stadium, and Woody Woodward was the player rep at the time. And he calls you and the other guys, the other bat boys, into the clubhouse. And what happens?
Well, we weren't really sure at the time what was going on, because nobody else was in the clubhouse. Woody calls us in, and there's no players, there's no coaches. Sparky's not there. Bernie's not there. And our first inclination was, okay, we're going to the playoffs, or are we getting replaced by somebody else? But it was totally the opposite of that. Woody had told us that the players had voted on the World Series shares, and they know how hard we worked, how many hours we put in, all we did for the players, and to show their appreciation to us, each one of the three of us got a quarter of a World Series share.
Which would have been how much?
After taxes, that came out to about $2,500 in 1970.
You were making $5 a game, $7 for doubleheaders at Crosley anyway, $2,500.
I know. It was unbelievable. We were shocked. Now, we would have gotten a little bit more if the Reds would have won the series, but still, the fact that the players did that is such an awesome memory.
You still have the check too, right?
I have a copy of the check.
Yeah.
Still have a copy of both checks. And the same thing happened in 1972. Darryl Chaney was the player rep at the time. Now, two of us were holdovers from 1970, Jim and myself, but we had a new kid who was the right field ball boy, Tom. And his first reaction when Darryl called us in was, are we getting fired? which was pretty humorous too. But we kind of knew, since we'd been there in 70, we kind of knew that there might be something going on here. And sure enough, we each got a quarter of a share. And after taxes on that was about $2,700.
Going back to 1970, the Reds would sweep the Pirates in the 1970 NLCS.
So the Big Red Machine wins a pennant for the first time in 9 years. A totally reconstructed team with a rookie manager and a cast of young stars.
And move on to face the Orioles in the World Series.
It's the series everybody wanted. The new Red menace in the National League and Baltimore's runaway Orioles.
What did you think of the clubhouse at Memorial Stadium in Baltimore? Because it was a big deal. You and your buddies got to make the trip out there.
My first plane ride ever as a 16-year-old was flying on the Reds charter to the World Series.
Wow.
Which is pretty awesome at that point. the Orioles clubhouse was not much different than the Reds clubhouse at Crosley Field. Clubhouses, they were just there so the players could get dressed and go play ball. It reminded me a lot of Crosley.
It's your first plane ride. You probably have some nerves a little bit about flying, and you're on this flight with Johnny Bench and Pete Rose and Sparky Anderson.
I know. It's just kind of unbelievable. And then we get on the bus and go to the team hotel. And the team hotel, there's a funny story involving that. So the team hotel was in downtown Baltimore, and it really wasn't in the greatest of neighborhoods. So we go to the front desk and we're talking and we're saying, well, where can we go? You know, teenage guys that want to do something. And the front desk said, I wouldn't advise going out after dark. We said, okay, well, I guess we won't go after dark. So we're in our hotel room. And there's a knock on the door. We answer it, and there's Tommy Helms and Jimmy Stewart, and they've got a present for us. They've got a case of beer. And their only advice went to us, and I feel I can tell this story because the statute of limitations, they're over now, I guess, aren't they?
Yeah.
Their only advice to us was, we know you guys can't go out. Here's some refreshments for you, and just don't drink it all in one night.
Oh, my gosh. You guys must have just felt like you had hit the lottery. You got a case of beer. You're on the flight with the Reds. And
I know. It was just like, is this really happening to me? When am I going to wake up from this dream?
In 1972, Game 5 of the NLCS was played at Riverfront.
Cincinnati is where it's at, the skyline over the Ohio. Fans converge in a breathtaking baseball plant, Riverfront Stadium.
And Johnny Bench hits a home run in the ninth inning.
Well, we're either going to start celebrating again in Pittsburgh very shortly, or all kinds of stuff is going to break loose here in Cincinnati in this ballpark.
What do you remember about that game?
I remember going into the bottom of the ninth inning. It was my last year as bat boy, and I'm thinking, oh, man, are we going to lose this game? You've got Dave Justy on the mound, the best relief pitcher in the National League. Pirates are defending world champs. I think they might have even been favored in the series. They've got a one-run lead going into the ninth inning. And I remember Johnny's at bat. He hit a ball down the left field line that was about 50 feet foul, that if it would have been fair, it would have been a home run. And normally a player will get one pitch to hit it out. And Johnny was pretty much a pull hitter in the early stages of his career. And so we thought, well, that was his pitch, you know. Sure enough, he hits a pitch to right field, which, you know, he didn't do all that often. And, of course, you've got Al Michaels with his famous call, you know, back goes Clemente.
One and two. The line. And a bench to bench. Change hit in the air to deep right field. Back goes Clemente. At the fence. She's done.
And the game's tied. And the stadium is just rocking and rolling. And the fans are going crazy. And I am got to go out there and get Johnny's bat and head back to the dugout. And the players are pulling out of the dugout to congratulate him. It was just mass celebration at that time. It was just crazy.
Speaking of picking up Johnny's bat, when a player would break their bat, and that would happen frequently, I'm sure, as it does today, would that just get thrown away or were you able to keep it?
At the time, a lot of those bats would just go back in the equipment room. And sometimes Bernie would let us take a broken bat, we'd repair it and like put a screw in it and tape it up and use it.
That game five of the 72 NLCS, that was Roberto Clemente's last game played. And Tom, who you mentioned before, one of your buddies, was the right field ball boy and had the privilege of what?
Well, Tom would toss with the players in between innings, and he was the last guy to toss with Roberto Clemente in a major league stadium. And we have since the four bat boys from that era, from 72, we have gotten together now on a regular basis the last couple of years, about once a quarter. And we tell stories, and some of the stories I've never heard before. And it's been just great to reconnect with those guys. And Tom was not aware that he was the last guy to toss with Clemente until we told him. And I still remember when we heard about the plane crash and Clemente passing away. It was just devastating. He was my favorite non-Reds player.
Before Game 2 of the 1972 World Series, you met a baseball icon, a legend, and I'm sure it's a moment you'll never forget.
You know, when I look back and think of all my experiences and all my relationships with people, you know, I knew Sparky Anderson and Joe Nuxall and Johnny Bench and Pete and all the great players. Both Tom and I, since we were in the Reds dugout, got an opportunity to meet Jackie Robinson. He tossed out the first ball in the 1972 World Series.
Today, we are about to honor the man Branch Rickey selected to lead the way, who set a brilliant example for all to follow. He is Hall of Famer Jackie Robinson.
I'm extremely proud and pleased to be here this afternoon, but must admit I'm going to be tremendously more pleased and more proud when I look at that third base coaching line one day and see a black face managing in baseball. Thank you very much.
He passed away less than 2 weeks later, so he was ill at the time. But that is probably one of the things I cherish the most, that talk about being in the right place at the right time. Oh my goodness, Jackie Robinson, what an iconic ball player and an iconic person, not only in baseball, but in this nation's history. And to have the opportunity to meet him. And the more I've read about him, the more I'm in awe of that moment.
Because of the courage of your mom, way back when, talking to Pete Rose about getting you a job. Like, if your mom does not have the courage to do that in that moment and fight for the opportunity to give Pete Rose his vaccinations, you're not there that day in 1972 to meet Jackie Robinson.
No, I don't have any of these experiences. I don't get to work for the Reds. I probably don't get to work in the Reds front office after college. I don't get to meet my wife at the Reds. I use the World Series money to pay for college. I mean, my life completely changed with my mom asking Pete Rose if her son could work down at Crosley Field.
Warren Brown, thank you so much. And Brownie, as they called you back in the day, right? How did you get that nickname, by the way, Brownie?
Well, with the last name of Brown, it wasn't too hard. Yeah. You know, everybody had a nickname and everybody called me Brownie except one person. Sparky always called me Warren.
He sent you Christmas cards all the way through his passing.
Sparky and I exchanged Christmas cards every year until he passed away. And I still have those Christmas cards, and those are great memories.
Yeah. And as you said, because we talked a couple weeks ago, that he was a great manager, yes, but an even better person.
Absolutely. When I think about it, I got the opportunity to really work with three people. And there's more than that, but these three people, I don't think you've ever heard anybody say a bad thing about them. And that would be Bernie Stowe, Sparky Anderson, and Joe Nuxall. And that's quite a
that's quite a list.
That's quite a list to have, let me tell you.
Yeah. Well, hey, Warren, thanks so much for the time. I appreciate it.
Mike, it's been my pleasure. Again, I just love to tell my stories to people that love baseball and love baseball history. Thank you for the opportunity.
You know what? It's like I said at the beginning of this episode, so many of these folks behind the scene have some of the best stories, and they just sit there untold. And so I'm just thankful we were able to talk to Warren Brown today and hear some of those stories of the Big Red Machine out of Crosley Field and Riverfront Stadium, two ballparks that are long since lost. The Lost Ballparks podcast is produced by Mike Dunn, Andy Zablakis, John Carter, Briggs Buckingham, Xavier Guerra, Alex Kemp, Mike Lipinski, Ryan Beard, and Kyle Schmidt. Looking forward to joining you again soon for another episode of the Lost Ballparks podcast.